This is Audible.
Penguin Audio presents Surviving Home by A. American, read by Duke Fontaine. Prologue. When it all went wrong, I was 200 miles from home. I traveled a lot for my job, and I always had my get-home bag in my car. It wasn't that I expected things to fall apart. By nature, I'm an optimist. But it always seemed to be the worst kind of irresponsibility to not be prepared. And it was that Boy Scout philosophy that saved my life. The car quit, my phone was dead, and pretty soon, I knew it wasn't just me. Everyone in the road was stuck and looking for a way home. I had known for a long time that if things ever went to shit, the average person was screwed. No power, no water, no food, no way to communicate with the government that was supposed to be running the show. And I knew that, in that situation, my fellow citizens would quickly become the biggest danger. What wouldn't you do if you couldn't feed your family? But what I wasn't prepared for was how quickly things would get bad. And in the weeks it took me to hoof it home, things got very bad indeed. The average person without food or water or hope would rob you for a meal. The average person in the same situation, but with kids to feed, might kill you. I'd thought about it a lot before the event, and I had tried to prepare. I didn't worry too much about my wife and three girls. My house was off the grid. We had food stored, solar power, and an independent water system. More important, I had good friends and neighbors. I knew people like my buddy Danny would look out for Mel and the girls. All I had to do was get home to them, and everything would be fine. That's what I thought, at least. Getting there wasn't easy. I got real lucky. I hooked up with Thad and Jess, and we looked out for each other. When I got shot, they saved my life, and we were luckier still. We met Linus Mitchell, Sarge, a retired soldier, and some of his army buddies. They got me back on my feet and made it possible for Jess, Thad, and I to make it home to our families. Coming home was the single best moment of my life. Things in my neighborhood were under control, and despite that the world had gone to hell, for a little while, it seemed like it was all going to be okay. We had a cookout the night I came home, and it wasn't very different from other gatherings like we had 100 times before. Family, friends, and hope. I know myself pretty well, and sometimes I can be kind of harsh about how people are adjusting to the world we live in now. It's a new world with new rules, and everybody has to make do for themselves. You have to make sure your family gets fed and make sure they're safe. There are too many people waiting for Uncle Sugar to fix things, people who thought at the beginning that if they just waited, things would go back to normal. But if I'm honest, the first night I got home, I wasn't too different. I thought the hard part was behind me, and I had no idea how bad things were going to get. I figured if I took care of my own, the rest would sort itself out. But I was wrong. Chapter 1. We went to bed early after the cookout. It was nice to sleep in my own bed with my wife beside me. Ashley, mostly we called her Little Bit, wanted to sleep with us and really put up a fight. But we wanted some time to ourselves. It had been a while since we'd been together, and we were going to make up for it. Afterward, Mel was asleep, and I was lying there, staring at the ceiling. In the past, I would have gotten up and gone online, but those days were over. No more internet. No more laptop. No more of a lot of things. I got up and walked out to the living room and sat down in my chair. The room was dark and silent. There was no AC running, no fan. No, nothing. Light washed over the window, and I heard an ATV heading toward the roadblock. I stood and looked out the front window as it passed by, and then the darkness and silence returned. I sat down again in my leather chair, but soon I was up again and returned to my bed, and Mel. Morning came, and I was up before the sun. Mel was still asleep, as were the girls. I put on a pot of water to boil. I stood there for a moment, taking the scene in, looking around at the kitchen, the fluorescent light glowing against the ceiling, and looking forward to coffee. The three-burner butterfly kerosene stove is a truly wonderful piece of equipment to have. Once the burner is lit and the catalytic converter heats up, it produces no smoke and can be used indoors. While the water was heating, I went out to the shop to look at the food stores. I was surprised at what I saw. Mel said she hadn't been very careful in the beginning, but that she had soon changed her ways and had started to conserve. It looked like the kids had put a real dent in the canned fruit. The soups and stews were hit rather hard, but there was still a lot there, and if we were careful, we could stretch it out for some time. It felt good standing there in front of those shelves, knowing it wasn't all a waste of time and money. I grabbed a can of Spam and headed back inside. The water was boiling, and I added it to the press. I let the coffee brew for a minute, set a skillet on the burner, and poured myself a cup with sugar and some powdered creamer. While the skillet heated, I added a little olive oil and sliced the Spam. From the fridge, I grabbed a few eggs and set them aside while the meat in the pan heated. Mel came into the kitchen and said, "I smell coffee and Spam." "Morning, sunshine," I said. She went to the cabinet and returned with a cup and poured it full of coffee. She doctored her cup while I was flipping the Spam. "When do the girls usually get up?" I asked, as I took the meat from the pan and cracked an egg into it. "They usually sleep late. No school and all. They couldn't be happier," she said, taking a sip from the cup. "Well, can't blame them. I would if I could," I said. We sat down at the table in the kitchen and ate breakfast together. The sun was starting to come up, and it looked like it would be a nice day. After another cup of coffee, I got up and headed for the bedroom. "Really? After last night, I can't believe you have the energy," she said with a smirk on her face. I paused at the door. "I have more energy than you can imagine." I put on my Carhartt pants and my Ariat boots, something other than those damn Bellevilles I had walked 200 miles home in. I pulled my TAC vest on and draped the sling of my assault rifle over my shoulders. Mel looked up from the cup in her hands. "Where are you going?" "I'm going to walk up to the end of the road and talk to Danny. I just want to see how things are around here." After strapping on the XD, I headed for the door and walked down the drive toward the gate in the early dawn. The dogs, Meathead and Little Girl, came running up and jumping all over me. I knew I wouldn't be able to keep them in the yard, so I just let them follow me. We went out onto the road and turned toward the roadblock. It wasn't long before the dogs went nuts, barking and raising hell. I looked back and saw what they were barking at. Coming down the road on her bike, like she usually did in the mornings, was Pat. "Shit," I said as I turned around and kept on toward the roadblock. I could hear her bike closing on me, and it wasn't long before she came alongside. "Hi, Morgan. I heard you were back," she said with a forced smile.
"Yeah, finally."
"How was it? Was it hard?" she asked. I looked over at her.
"More than you can imagine."
"I bet. We haven't been anywhere since all this happened. Neither of our cars work, so we haven't gone out," Pat said as she pedaled her bike. "We are almost to the roadblock. I just wanted her to go the hell away." "How's your family? Are your girls getting enough to eat?" she asked. I saw what she was after. Pat was always a busybody, and now she was snooping around to figure out who had food. I just looked over at her and smiled. We reached the roadblock, and I waved at Danny, who was walking toward me. He gave me a wave back, and we shook hands.
"Hey, man," Danny said.
Pat rolled off to the side of the road and pretended to fiddle with the chain on her bike, just close enough to get an earful. Reggie was at the roadblock with Danny this morning. He looked over and gave me a nod, and Pat waved at him too. He waved back without a smile. Our little neighborhood had two basic groups. There was Pat and her group, mostly old biddies, and the ones where the woman of the house pretty much ran things, plus a few others that had that holier-than-thou attitude. The second was the rest of us, the ones who minded their own business but were always ready to lend a hand.
"Nah, haven't seen a soul, just like most days,"
Reggie said. Yeah, early on there were several people heading for the forest, loaded with packs, some old trucks, some bikes, and carts and shit. Then it pretty much dried up. Not too many people anymore, Danny said. Then why keep this up? I asked. Because there are still some shifty-ass folks that come through here, plus some other shit, Reggie said. Like what? Danny and Reggie shared a glance. Then Danny spoke. There have been a few girls come up missing. They disappear from their homes or went out walking around. No one knows what's happening to them. They just disappear. I looked down. I'd forgotten about the bodies. I mean, it was in my head. I just hadn't said anything about it. What with coming home and seeing everyone and the cookout we had the night before, it had slipped my mind. I was going to talk to you about it. I just didn't want to last night with the girls there. The last thing in the world I can imagine is one of them disappearing, Danny said. It's not that. I mean, it is definitely that, but on my way back, not far from here, I found the bodies of three people. One of them looked familiar, but I couldn't place the face, or what was left of it. I looked up at Danny and Reggie. Where? Reggie asked, an edge to his voice. Sorry, Reggie. Morgue. Reggie's niece has been missing for about a week. She lived over in Altoona, near the kangaroo store, and just disappeared, Danny said. Reggie, man, I'm sorry, I didn't know. I found them out at Baptist Lake. Two of them had been there a while. There wasn't much left, and it was hard to tell whether they were male or female, I said. Reggie looked me in the eye. You stay here with Danny. I'm going to get Rick and Mark and some ATVs, then we're going to look for her. Bring someone back to man the barricade. I'm going too. Morg can ride with me, Danny said. Reggie nodded at Danny, then looked back to me. What color was the hair, Morgan? I looked at Danny, and he looked back with no expression. Blonde, long, past the shoulders, I said. Reggie's jaw tightened, and he nodded his head. He went over and climbed on his ATV and took off like his ass was on fire. Pat managed to fix her bike a moment after and headed down the road as fast as her pudgy legs would carry her. Danny looked over at me. I shrugged my shoulders. I didn't know, I said. I know, but this has had people scared. The thought that, with everything else that's going on, some sick fuck is going around snatching girls has really had an effect, Danny said. I leaned over the barricade, and Danny came up beside me and rested his elbows on it. We just stood there as the sun climbed higher. He asked about my trip home, and I gave him some of the details. I told him about Sarge and the guys, about Thad and Jess, and what we had gone through. I told him the story of our ambush in detail, all that I remembered, anyway. I told him about Sarge's place and my trip through the forest. He laughed when I told him about the hippies. Man, I wish we were on the run today, just paddling down without a care in the world, he said, staring off across the road. Me too, man, me too, I replied. It wasn't too long before we heard the ATVs coming up the road. We both looked back and saw two four-wheelers and one Kawasaki mule coming down the road. Mark was in the mule. He and Rick, another guy from the neighborhood, had their uniforms on. Mark's sheriff's star clearly visible, even at this distance. Behind them, her legs pumping up and down, was Pat. The guys came up and stopped. Reggie asked me to tell Mark and Rick what I had told him. As he relayed the story, Pat rolled up. I stopped talking as everyone turned to look at her. Breathlessly, she climbed off her bike and put the kickstand down. Mark had his son Jeremy in the mule with him, and Lance was on the back of Rick's ATV. Jeremy and Lance would man the barricade while we were gone. Pat looked at Jeremy and told him to watch her bike while she was gone. We all looked around at one another, wondering where she was going. Without saying a word to anyone, Pat walked over and climbed into the mule. Mark looked over at her and said, "What are you doing, Pat?" "I'm going with you. This is serious, and we need to find out what's going on," she said as she pulled on a pair of knit gloves. "You're right, it is, but you aren't going anywhere. Now please get out of there," Mark said. "I most certainly will not. I have as much a right here as any of you do," she said. "I'm still a deputy sheriff, and this is police business. I asked you once to leave, now I'm telling you," Mark said. Pat shot him a look, then one to me and Danny. If those two are going, I can. They aren't deputies. Rick looked over to Danny and me and said, You two want to be deputies? We looked at one another and shrugged. Sure. You're deputized, Rick said. You're not the sheriff. You can't deputize anyone, she fired back. Pat, I've been nice, Mark said, as he and Rick moved toward her. Sensing what was coming, Pat leaned forward and wrapped her arms around the roll bar of the mule. Rick and Mark pried her arms off as graciously as they could. Pat was screaming like she was being eaten by a gator. Stop the damn screeching, Pat. You're being fucking ridiculous, Mark said. They finally got her out of the mule and walked her over to her bike, and Rick handcuffed her right hand to the handlebar. What are you doing? Pat yelled. Rick walked over and handed a cuff key to Lance. When we're gone, take them off her. Take it off the bike first, then her wrist. I want those back. Lance nodded and pocketed the key. Pat shot him a look. With Pat finally out of the way, Mark looked at all of us and asked, You guys ready? Everyone nodded and moved toward the machines. I was headed toward Danny's Polaris when Mark called out to me. Ride with me, Morgan. I don't know where we're going. Mark pulled a bag from the bed of the mule and handed everyone a radio. There were also three body bags lying there. Where did you get these? I asked him. The sheriff's office had some stuff that still worked. After he handed them out, we did a quick radio check. I climbed into the mule and we pulled through the barricade. I said, Head up toward the Pittman Center and take that trail just past it to the left. Baptist Lake is back there. He was focused on the road ahead and seemed a little tense. I asked, Has old Pat been that big a pain in the ass the whole time? I mean, she's always been a pain, but that seemed a little over the top. Yeah, she's been trying to coordinate everyone to work together. She tells everyone what to do. She wants us all to throw everything in a big pile to share, he said. She must be out of food then. Mark looked over at me and said, That's what I think too. I pointed out the trail shortly after we passed the visitor center in Pittman. We all turned off the road onto the trail. It didn't take long to get back to the lake. Winters were rather dry around here, and there weren't any real wet places to negotiate. We came at the lake from the north side, and the bodies I had seen were on the south side. I told Mark about where they were and pointed in the general direction. He stopped the mule and waved the others forward. Reggie, Rick, and Danny all came up alongside. Rick, you and Danny go around that side. Reggie, you follow us around this side. Keep an eye out, and when you get down there, no one go running off toward the area. Let's see if we can find anything that might tell us who's doing this. We don't have a forensic team, but let's see if there's anything that might help us. Everyone nodded, and we all headed off. Reggie was trailing behind us, and Mark wasn't going very fast. I glanced over my shoulder at Reggie, and he just looked pissed. Looking over at Mark, I said, Good idea having him follow behind you. He looks like he's ready to kill someone right now. That's why he's back there. I wanted him to go slow. Otherwise, he would have hauled ass down there, and if there was anything that might help, he'd probably fuck it up. I sure hope this isn't his niece, Mark said. It didn't take long to make our way around the little lake. The water was low, and a large part of the bottom was exposed. As we neared the area where I'd found the bodies, I told Mark, and he stopped the mule as Reggie came up beside us. Why are we stopping? Reggie asked. They were right over there, I answered him, pointing off toward the near side of the lake, where three or four buzzards were taking to the air. Reggie squinted his eyes and looked out over the dry lake bed. Rick and Danny had come out of the tree line a couple of hundred yards to our left and stopped. We all dismounted and walked toward the bottom end of the little lake. There wasn't anything that said, body over here, and I couldn't really remember exactly where they were, but it wasn't a large area to search. Just a minute later, Rick found a femur. It was lying in the dirt alone, no other bones around it. Out of habit, more than anything else probably. Rick took a business card from his pocket, folded it in half, and set the little paper tent on the ground beside the bone. From where we were standing, two lumps were clearly visible. A few moments later, we were standing over what was left of two of the bodies I had just found a couple of days back. The one that had looked the worst for wear that day was now nothing more than bones held together by connective tissue. The one that appeared to be freshly dumped was in pretty bad shape now. The various critters that feed on carrion had been hard at work. We stood in a semicircle around the bodies. Mark and Rick looked at the ground and the surrounding area for any sort of clue as to who had dumped them. Reggie just stood there, staring at the body with matted blonde hair. Finally, he looked over at Mark and said, "I want to check her and see if it's Christine." Mark looked over at him and frowned. "From the condition of the body, how are you going to tell?" "Looks like most of the backside is still there. She has a tattoo in her lower back, kind of a tribal thing with a butterfly in the middle." "I want to know now," Reggie said with a finality that Mark couldn't argue with. Mark and Rick pulled black nitrile gloves from their pockets and put them on. Kneeling down, they turned the body over. While the animals hadn't been able to get at the backside of the body, the insects certainly had, but there was still enough of a tattoo visible to make it out. Reggie reached into his shirt pocket and pulled out a photo. It was of a blonde girl, probably 18 or 19, with her shirt pulled up over her fresh tattoo. She was looking back over her shoulder at whoever took the picture with a huge smile on her face, her perfectly white teeth shining in the flash of the camera. Reggie looked at the picture, then at the body, then at the photo. He handed the picture to Mark. "It's her. I have to take her home to her mama." Mark took the photo and looked at it. He shook his head, looking at the once beautiful young girl in the picture. Standing up, he handed it back to Reggie and walked over to the mule and grabbed the body bags. "I don't see much here that would help us. We'll take the bindings and I'll make a sketch of these tire tracks. Maybe they'll be handy later." We spent about an hour collecting all the bodies. One of them was pretty scattered, and we tried to make sure we found all the bones, though I know we didn't. When we were done, we loaded two bags into the mule. Reggie insisted on taking the one with Christine in it on his four-wheeler. He laid the bag across the rear rack and strapped it with a couple of bungee cords. With the bodies loaded, we all climbed back on the various machines and headed back toward home. When we came to our road, the four of us pulled off, but Reggie kept going toward Daltuna. He didn't say anything as he passed. We pulled up to the barricade, where Lance and Jeremy were sitting. Rick went up to Lance and put his hand out. Lance dropped the cuffs into it. Rick put them on his belt, then looked back at Lance. "The key, too." Lance gave a sly little smile and reached into his pocket and pulled out the key, handing it over as well. "Did she give you any trouble?" Mark asked. "She was pissed. She cussed you for all you're worth, but no, she didn't give me any trouble. She told me I would regret it, and that you had no right to lock her up like a dog," Lance said. I stepped out of the mule and went over to Danny's Polaris and climbed on. "Drop me off at the house," I said, as my ass landed on the seat. Danny pulled up to the front of the house. After I climbed off, he asked if I could come down to his place later and see if I could come up with some ideas to get some power going. We shook, and I went up to the porch where Mel was sitting with a cup of coffee. She waved at Danny as he pulled away. "Where'd you go?" "I saw all the four-wheelers go by. What's up?" she asked. I told her about the bodies. It upset her, the thought of some sick bastard running around doing something like that at a time like this. She also worried for our girls, and I assured her that they weren't going anywhere without us, except down to Danny and Bobby's house. There was only one way onto our street, and we had decent security, so I wasn't worried about them walking down the road. Mel asked if I wanted a cup of coffee, and I said I would love one. She went inside and came back with another cup, and hers refilled. We sat on the bench drinking our coffee when the door opened, and little Bit came out. She was dragging a giant tawny-colored teddy bear, peanut butter. She looked so cute in her little footy PJs. Rubbing her eyes, she came over and climbed up in my lap and laid her head on the bear. It was wonderful beyond words to have that little girl in my lap, just to be sitting here with Mel and knowing all my girls were safe. After a moment, she raised her little head and looked over the edge of my cup.
"Can I have some coffee, Daddy? Can you move this?"
She was pointing at the AR lying on my lap. I pulled the sling over my head and set the rifle aside. Sure, baby, I said, as she took the cup with her little hands. She took a sip and hummed with pleasure. She looked up with a big smile.
It's good. Can I have the rest of it?
This was the eternal question from her. Can I have more? It didn't matter what it was. Anything she had some of, she wanted the rest of. Maybe it came from having two older sisters, being the smallest. Get what you can get, when you can get it.
Of course, drink it up. When you're done, go get dressed.
Okay, she said, and raised the cup again. We sat on the porch, and little Bit finished her coffee. I tousled her long blonde hair, making her giggle. She finally finished her coffee and climbed off my lap, and headed back into the house, the bear trailing behind her. Mel looked over at me and said, "You let her drink that. She's your problem for the rest of the day."
"No sweat. I have a lot to do today. She can follow along," I said, and stood up. "I'm going to go out to the shop and check out the solar system and go through a few things."
"All right. I'm going to clean up the kitchen." I headed out to the shop and was checking out the batteries, looking for any corrosion on the terminals, when I heard a high-pitched voice call.
"Daddy?"
"In here."
Little Bit came through the door.
"What you doing?"
"Just checking a few things," I told her. She helped me as I went over the batteries, cables, and inverter. Then I went through the food stored there. It still looked like a lot of food, but when you thought of the fact that there was no way to run to the store, it wasn't. I was standing there, looking over the stores, when Little Bit asked,
"What's wrong, Daddy?"
"Nothing. Just looking at all the food we have." I chose the words carefully so as not to let her think I was worried. This wasn't her problem, and her little mind didn't need to be troubled with it.
"Yeah. We have a lot, don't we?"
she said.
"We have some."
I looked down at her. She turned to look up at me. "But don't tell anyone about it, okay?" I said as I patted her head. She leaned her head against my side, turning her face into me.
"I won't.
Someone might try and steal it. If anyone tries to steal it, I'll shoot them with my BB gun," she said. "Don't go trying to shoot anyone. If you see anyone, you tell me," I told her.
"Okay. Can I go get my BB gun?" she asked.
"Sure. Just be careful with it." She was on her way before I even finished saying it. After she was gone, I pulled the 20mm ammo cans out from under the shelves and did a quick inventory of the ammo. I had about 4,700 rounds for the AR and 1,250 for the 45s. There were also close to 1,000 rounds of 22 caliber, 110 30-30 rounds, and 50 12-gauge shells mixed with double-aught buck and slugs, both high brass. I felt pretty good about the count. It wasn't an unlimited supply, but it was a substantial stockpile. About then, Little Bit came through the door with her red rider in one hand, a length of 550 cord in the other. She said,
"Daddy, can you put this rope on my gun so I can wear it like you do yours?"
I smiled at her and took a moment to fashion a sling for her little rifle. She stood there with a smile on her face, then put the sling over her shoulder when I was done and ran out of the shop. Going back inside, I found Taylor and Leanne awake. Leanne was standing in the kitchen, looking in the fridge.
"I'm hungry," she announced. "I want some eggs."
She took the bowl that had the fresh eggs in it from the fridge.
"Dad, can you light the stove for me? I can't do it."
"Sure," I replied. I lit the stove and adjusted the knob for a low flame. She took a 10-inch skillet down and set it on the stove. I told her that was too big, and I replaced it with an 8-inch. I showed her how to pour a little oil in the pan and keep the eggs moving so they wouldn't stick. Like any teenager, she told me, "I know." So I left her to her breakfast, telling her to clean up after herself and making sure she knew how to shut the stove off. In short order, there was a small argument over what she and her sister thought they should make. I was in the bathroom when I heard the sliding glass door open and close. As I was coming back out of my room, Taylor came through the door again with a can of red feather cheddar cheese in her hand.
"What are you doing with that?" I asked her.
"I'm going to make a cheese omelet," she replied, as she reached for a can opener.
I took the can from the counter. "You do not just go get what you want out of the shop. You have to ask before you get anything," We have to be careful with what we have. We only have 12 cans of this. You can't just use it for yourselves. Do you two understand? Taylor looked dejected.
Yes, I just wanted something different.
Leanne was nodding her head.
I didn't want the cheese anyway, she said.
I put the can back on a shelf in the kitchen and went to find Mel. We needed to talk about the food situation. Chapter 2. After a long day, Thad was sitting in his chair in front of a low fire in the fireplace. Anita was putting little Tony to bed. Thad looked across the room at his mother, who sat in an old rocking chair, her hands folded in her lap. She had a smile on her face and was looking at Thad.
What are you smiling at, Mama? Thad asked.
You, baby. You know how proud I am of you? You know how much I love you? Then she slowly started to rock her chair. Thad sat there looking back at her with a grin on his face.
I know. You gave me a lot of love over the years. I've always been proud of you. You're a good man, and don't let anyone ever tell you different, she said as she rocked.
I tried to make you proud. It was important to me.
You okay?
Oh, I'm fine. You came home, his mother replied and smiled. She started to rise from the chair, and Thad came over and helped her up. She said she was tired and ready for bed. Thad helped her down the hall, carrying a candle to light the way. He helped her onto the edge of her bed, where she pulled down the linens and made ready to get in. Thad set the candle on the nightstand, and his mother asked him to hand her her Bible.
You gonna be able to read with just this candle, Mama? Thad asked.
No, baby. I'm not gonna read. I just want to buy me, is all. Thad handed her the Bible, and she swung her legs up and onto the bed. Thad helped her get the blankets arranged. After pulling the covers up, Thad leaned down and kissed her on the forehead. She placed her hands on either side of his face.
You a good man. I love you. You came home. You came home to me.
And to Anita and Tony, she said with a smile. Thad took her hands in his and squeezed them tight.
I love you too, Mama.
And I have all I need now with you, Anita and Tony. If I didn't have anything else in the world, that's all that I would need. She smiled at him.
Good night, son, she said.
She still had a smile on her face as Thad closed the door. He went out to the living room where Anita was sitting on the sofa. He sat down beside her.
Mama seemed like she acted a little weird to you, he asked.
She sat on the porch looking down the road, waiting for you. She said all along that you would come home.
She knew it. I knew it too. But she was so damn certain. She just seems so happy now, like she's finished something, Anita said.
Thad sat there for a minute thinking, but he said nothing more. He put his arm around Anita and pulled her close. She laid her head on his shoulder. They sat there a little longer before Thad got up and put two large logs in the fire before going to bed. Thad woke before the sun came up, as was his habit now, and dressed as quietly as he could. Anita stretched and sat up, sliding her feet into her slippers and reaching for her robe. They exchanged good mornings and a quick kiss as Thad headed for the living room. The fire was all but dead. There was just a slight glow coming from what was left of the bottom of one of the big logs he had put on before bed. Piling on some pine needles, he blew them into a flame and then added a small piece of lighter wood and some small sticks to get the fire going again. Giving the renewed flame time to take, he added some larger sticks. Satisfied the fire would sustain itself, he headed for the back door. Thad pulled his coat on as he opened the door and stepped out. The cold seemed to wrap itself around him, and he quickly zipped up the coat. He walked out to the old barn to relieve himself. He had instituted this as a new rule in the house. He and little Tony would urinate outside. Hauling water into the house to flush the toilets was getting old. Little Tony thought it was fun to pee outside, and on those first times when he stood beside his father as they both did it, he would giggle and laugh. Thad couldn't help but laugh too, at the little boy finding humor in something as simple as peeing on the ground. As he was answering the morning call, he arched his shoulders against the cold. Going back inside, he found Anita at work in the kitchen on breakfast. "Where's Mama?" he asked as he took off his coat. "She ain't up yet." Thad hung his coat on the hook by the door and headed down the hall. Opening his mother's door, he found her still in bed. He stood there for a minute looking at her, thinking she was asleep, but a strange feeling came over him. He went up to her and looked closer. She had her Bible on her chest with her arms crossed over it. She looked peaceful, too peaceful. Thad reached down and took her hand. It was cold, and when he felt her neck, it too was cold. He stood there for another moment, allowing it to sink in, and then he slowly knelt down beside the bed. He wrapped his hands around hers and rested his forehead on them. She was gone. He didn't cry, but there was a hole in him now that he thought would never be filled. Slowly, he laid her hand back on her Bible and stood up, and as he did, he saw the dress on the foot of the bed. It hadn't been there last night. It was one of her church dresses, a simple black dress with a sewn-in white belt at the waist. A wide white collar was the only other adornment. Lying on top of it was a white hat with an upturned brim and a white net veil over it. Thad slowly walked out to the kitchen. "Where's Tony?" he asked his wife. "He's still in bed." Then she looked up. "What's wrong, baby?" she asked as she came to him. "Mama's gone," was all he said. Anita looked up at him, and tears started to fill her eyes. "Oh, baby, I'm so sorry. She waited for you. She knew it was coming, but she waited for you." She laid her head on his chest and sobbed quietly. Thad's mother had been as much of a mother to her as to Thad. She and Thad had met when they were in their late teens, and she had practically grown up with his mother, calling her Mama all the while. Thad quietly moved away from his wife toward the door. Anita looked up at him and asked, "Where are you going?" "Mama needs a coffin. I can't throw dirt in her face," he said, pulling the coat on for a second time. "But where are you going to get one?" she asked. "Gotta build one, I guess." Thad stopped with his hand on the doorknob. "I hate to ask, but can you dress her?" Anita paused a moment and then gave him a sad smile. "Sure," she said. Thad walked out to the old barn, made from rough-cut cypress log planks. He took a pry bar and hammer and began to pull the boards off the side of the barn. Once he had what he thought was enough and had carried them to the workbench, he began to saw them into lengths, trimming the sides so they were straight. The work was slow, with only hand tools, and around 10 in the morning, Anita came out with a cup of coffee for him. She looked at the box taking shape on the two sawhorses. She put an arm around her husband and stood there with him for a moment. Neither of them said a word. Thad looked at Anita and gave her a sad little smile, more of a crack in his face than a grin. She smiled back and nodded her head. "It's a nice dress you laid out," she said to him. "It is a nice dress, but I didn't lay it out. It was there when I went in this morning." Anita thought about that for a moment. She picked it out. Thad didn't want to believe his mother knew she would pass, but then he thought of the things she had said to him the night before. He had thought they were weird then, even more so now. Around 1 in the afternoon, when old Mr. Jackson stopped by the house, he found Thad at work on the box. "Sorry to hear about your mother, son," he said, as he stood looking at the rough coffin taking shape. "Thank you. I appreciate you looking out for mine while I was gone," Thad said, his hammer poised over a nail. "That's when neighbors are for. I'll go by and get the brother. I'm sure you would like to have a little service for her," the old man said, running his hand over the rough boards. "That would be nice. Mama would like it." "Wood's a little rough, huh?" "Well, it's all I got. I ain't throwing dirt in my mama's face, so this'll have to do," Thad said, then hammered another nail in. "Dug a grave yet?" "Not yet. Soon as this is done, I'll get to it." "You need some help? When I get back with the brother, I'll give you a hand." "Thanks, but I planned on doing it alone. Little Tony wants to help, but I don't want him digging his grandma's grave."
No different than a son digging his mama's grave, but I see what you mean. He is still a boy, but it's a different world now, Dad, Mr. Jackson said. I know. Some things I just want to keep from him a little longer. There'll be plenty of time for death yet, Dad said, picking up another nail. I'll be back. Y'all need anything? No, sir. Thanks for asking. Mr. Jackson went back through the house to see Anita and make sure she was okay. He asked if Tony could go for a ride in the truck with him to get him out of the house for a while. Anita thought it was a good idea and allowed him to go. For Tony, a ride in anything was a rarity anymore, so he jumped at the chance. When Thad finished the box, he took up a shovel and went to the rear of the backyard. His mother had a rose bush planted there. It had been there as long as Thad could remember, and he would bury her in front of it. Taking off his coat and hanging it on a fence post, Thad set the blade into the ground and placed his foot on it. He paused for a moment, with his foot poised, saying a prayer for his mother, thanking God for her long life and for welcoming her into heaven. With that done, he thrust the blade into the ground. The dark loam gave way easily to the spade. The ground was not as hard as Thad had thought it would be, or maybe he was getting some help. When Mr. Jackson returned with the brother from the little Baptist church his mother attended without fail, Thad was waist deep in a hole. The brother and Mr. Jackson walked out to the grave and looked down at Thad. "Sorry for your loss, Thad, but you know she's already with God," said the brother. "Thank you, Pastor Fish. I know. Makes it easier." The brother was a black man in his 50s. He was wearing a black suit for the occasion. Taking off his coat, he unbuttoned his sleeves and rolled the cuffs up. "Step out of there, son." Thad knew he wouldn't be able to argue with the man, and did as he was told. "You go get yourself a drink. Have you had lunch today?" Pastor Fish asked. "No, sir. But we're planning on having dinner after the service. You'll stay, won't you? And you, Mr. Jackson?" "Thad, I'm a Baptist preacher. I will not pass up a meal from one of the congregation." "It's the 11th commandment," the preacher said, as he took up the spade and stepped into the hole. Thad grinned and went to the house. Anita met him at the door with a glass of water. They talked for a moment about the dinner and that he had invited the brother and Mr. Jackson. She told him she'd figured they would stay and had already planned on it. The dinner would be simple: pork chops, collard greens, pinto beans, and cornbread. Thad said that sounded fine to him, drained his glass, gave his wife a kiss, and went back out to the gravesite. The brother was still there in the hole and told Thad that he and Mr. Jackson would finish the work. He needed to get cleaned up for the service. Thad turned back to the house. Anita led him to the bathroom, where he found an old washtub sitting on the toilet, steam rising from it. He looked over his shoulder at Anita, and she said, "I figured you'd need to clean up, and I didn't think them two would let you do any more work today." When Thad finished washing, the house was empty. Looking out the kitchen window, he saw everyone outside by the grave. He had kept himself busy all day, not thinking about the fact that she was gone. Now, with the coffin sitting beside the grave, the pile of fresh earth next to it, it was undeniable. As he came up to the group, Anita reached out and took one hand, little Tony the other. Mr. Jackson took off his straw hat, and the brother opened his Bible. "We are not here to mourn a death. We are here to celebrate a life. Beatrice was the kindest soul I ever knew, and I mean that. She never had a cross word for anyone." Thad snickered, causing the brother to pause and Anita to look up at him. Everyone looked at him expectantly. "Said my daddy when he was still with us," he said. The brother closed his Bible over a finger, holding it in one hand. "Well, you got me there, Thad. Let me rephrase that. She never had a cross word for anyone, except Amos, when he was still with us, rest his soul. He was all the more reason the woman was a saint to put up with him." The last part was said with the brother's face raised toward the sky, his arms held slightly out and apart. Thad and Anita both gave a soft laugh, which changed the mood of the service. Now it felt more like a celebration. After a short sermon, it was time to lower the coffin into the grave. Thad hadn't thought of how to go about it, but was pleased to see that Mr. Jackson had.
When it was time, he motioned Thad to the other side of the hole and told him to take up the ropes lying there. They each grabbed a rope in either hand and lowered the coffin. When it was finally resting in the bottom of the grave, Pastor Fish took up the spade and a scoop of earth. He held it over the grave and said, "Ashes to ashes, dust to dust. From the earth we come, to the earth we shall return." With that, he slowly shook the dirt out into the hole onto the box. When he was done, he handed the shovel to Thad, and he too took up a scoop of earth. He held the shovel over the hole for a moment, saying nothing. He just stood there looking down, and after a moment, he slowly dumped the dark soil into the hole. Anita took up the spade next and did as the others had, followed by Mr. Jackson. Little Tony reached down and took up a handful of dirt and dropped it into the grave. The little boy stood there for a moment, looking down into the hole, then looked up at his dad and said, "Mima's in heaven now." Thad looked down at the little boy and said, "She sure is, son. She sure is." Anita and Tony went into the house to prepare dinner, while the men saw to the task of filling the grave. When the grave was covered, Mr. Jackson looked over at Thad. "Do you have a marker for her?" Thad looked at the rose bush at the head of the grave. "That'll do. She tended that rose bush for years. It would live longer than any of us. I think it will make a fine marker for her." Pastor Fish put an arm around Thad's shoulder. "I think it's a fine marker, son. No stone or piece of wood would be nearly as lovely." Thad looked at him and nodded his head with a little smile. The men picked up their coats and headed for the house. On the back porch, they found a wash tub full of water waiting on them, along with a bar of soap and a hand towel. All the men washed their hands, then went inside. Anita and Tony had set the table, plate of thick chops in the center, a bowl of pinto beans, and a large bowl of collard greens. Everyone took a seat, and Pastor Fish said grace, thanking the Lord for life well lived, for the continuing lives of those present, and for keeping them all safe. When the grace was said, the plates were passed around the table, where a chop, beans, and greens were spooned onto each. Anita got up from the table and went to the stove. Opening the oven, she took a cake of cornbread out and carried it over to the table. Seeing the cornbread, Mr. Jackson rose from the table, saying, "That reminds me." He went outside, returning with a paper bag under his arm. Sitting back down at the table, he pulled a quart jar of honey out of the bag. This brought a smile to everyone's face. Talk around the dinner table was friendly, and nothing was said of death. The talk centered around fond memories and of things to come. A little fear was mixed with this. As everyone was finishing up, Pastor Fish said, "Miss Anita, thank you for a wonderful meal. I haven't had anything this good in a long time." "It wasn't much, but thank you." "It was lovely, Miss Anita. Don't doubt it," Mr. Jackson added. "That's why I married her. She's a fine cook," Thad said, as he put an arm around his wife. She shot him a look and pushed his arm off. "Oh, really?" she said. Thad faltered, and everyone let out a laugh. Anita smiled, and Thad started to laugh too. Chapter 3. Sarge was sitting on the deck in front of the shack. For a change, he was relaxed and not cussing anyone, but that may have been because no one was around. He was leaned back in the chair with his feet up on an old cypress stump he had cut and used as a footstool or table, depending on the moment. His M4 was lying in his lap, and he was drinking coffee from one of the ridiculously stained 101st mugs. He was sitting patiently and quietly waiting. He didn't have to wait long. From over his left shoulder came a stern command. "Do not move. Raise your hands where I can see them." Sarge smiled and raised his cup to his lips, taking a sip of the black coffee. The voice came over his shoulder again. "I said, raise your hands where I can see them, or you're a dead man." "You boys may as well come on out where I can see you, before I kill all four of you," Sarge said, as he lowered his cup. A long pause followed, and Sarge just sat there with a grin. He had heard them long before they ever saw his place, and had arranged a little welcoming party for them. Finally, a voice he knew yelled out, "Linus, they made me bring him. Don't kill me." It was Don. Sarge hadn't seen him since the day he went to his store in Suwannee. Since what went down there, the gunfight with the Department of Homeland Security assholes, he hadn't even thought of him.
"All right, come on out before I kill the three of you then," Sarge said, taking another sip of coffee.
After another short pause, the voice called out again, "Is Mike, Ted, and Doc here?" Sarge set his cup down on the deck.
"Lay down your weapons and come on up here so we can talk like men. I'm going to stand up now, and your hands better be empty when I do."
He stood up, flipping the safety off on his M4, and started toward the corner of the shack. Rounding the corner, he saw Don standing in front of three camoed men. They were wearing the same outfits that Mike and his crew wore, and all of them were soaking wet.
"Where's all their guns, Don?" Sarge asked.
"Well, they laid them all down back there," Don replied, jutting a thumb over his shoulder.
Sarge looked over Don's shoulder.
"You three come on up here where I can see you."
The three men cautiously stepped forward with their hands half raised.
"You boys ain't real stealthy, are you?" Sarge asked.
The three men looked at one another, then at Don. Don just shrugged his shoulders. Sarge asked,
"What are you guys doing here?"
and lowered the M4 to waist level.
"We're looking for Mike and Ted," the one in the front of the trio answered.
"For what?"
Sarge asked.
"We're friends of theirs. We need their help."
"We'll see about that. Mike, come out here and see if you know these dipshits," Sarge called out.
Mike came out from under the deck. He had been standing in the water under the cabin, looking up through the cracks at the men as they stood there. Ted was out in the swamp, crouched behind an old cypress stump. He had zip-tied ferns to his boonie hat. That, along with the camo paint on his face, made him practically invisible. Doc was inside the cabin, lying under one of the cots. As Mike came out from under the deck, he said,
"Hey, Andy."
The one that had answered Sarge's questions looked down into the dark water at the camoed face looking up at him.
"Mike?"
"Yep. Travis, Chris, what's up?"
Mike said, wiping muddy water out of his eyes.
An hour later, Sarge stood up from the table, took off his hat, and ran his hand through the gray stubble on his head.
He let out a long breath and stood there with his hands on his hips.
"You guys actually think this can be done?" he asked.
Don piped up.
"I told him that was fucking nuts," he said,
then opened up another of Sarge's Sam Adams. Sarge glared at him, then looked back to Andy.
"It's still in the planning. We're waiting for confirmation from other unit commanders that they're on board. We can't use the usual comms, so it's going a little slow," Andy said.
"How far up does this little goat rope go?"
Sarge asked.
"As far as we know, all the way to the commander in chief," Andy said.
"You realize what you're talking about is mutiny, pure and simple. Under the current circumstances, I don't think there will be any quarter for anyone involved. There's only success or death."
"Everyone involved is well aware of the circumstances," Andy said.
They discussed the details, Sarge asking questions the whole way. The plan was still in its infancy and was being developed on the fly. The gist of it was that the DHS was being used as a Praetorian Guard of sorts to carry out a transformation of the country. With more than 200,000 people working for DHS directly and another 60,000 working for the TSA, it was a substantial force. Granted, only a fraction were under arms, but that number was growing by the day. Inside the Department of Defense, there were also rumors that foreign military contractors, as well as domestic corporations, were to be mobilized in the effort. The plan by the administration was bold, to say the least. It had a slim chance of success if everything went right, let alone amidst the eddies of chaos currently beginning to swirl across the nation. Dedicated patriots in the armed forces of the U.S. had come to a decision early on to resist. That didn't mean that everyone in uniform was ready to defend the nation from threats within, but enough were.
"What do you need from us? You came out here, so what do you want?" Sarge asked.
Andy looked over at Mike and Ted. Doc was out on watch along with Chris.
he said. These guys are already on a termination list. DHS knows what they look like and is actively looking for them. He looked back at Sarge. They know you're with them, but they don't really know who you are or what you look like. We need to use that to our advantage.
Well, in the big scheme of things, we're pretty small fish, really, Sarge said.
True, but we're responsible for the situation here in Florida. Well, my commanding officer is. What he wants from you guys is harassing actions. He wants you guys to conduct guerrilla assaults against them at any opportunity.
Sarge stood there for a minute, thinking, taking it in. He looked at Mike and Ted. They met his eyes and nodded.
Your call, boss, Ted said.
Mike gave a quick couple of nods of his head. Sarge looked back at Andy.
Hell, I ain't even in the damn army anymore.
Andy smiled and said, Then you can't be charged with mutiny, can you?
Sarge laughed and said, Not that it really matters.
Sarge asked Andy about support. If they were to conduct raids against the DHS, they would need more than a couple of carbines and one machine gun. Andy made Sarge's day when he told him that they had a care package for him. It consisted of some demo and incendiary goodies, ammo, and another M249. What really brought a smile to Sarge's face was the four AT-4s and the M203 and the 25 HE rounds for it.
Well, where the hell is it?
Sarge exclaimed. Andy said it was in the boat they had come in on, and he told Chris and Travis to go bring it in. Sarge asked the others if they were hungry. He was always looking for a reason to cook.
Andy said, Hell, Sarge, I'm in the army. I'm always hungry.
Sarge went to his little kitchen and began to whip up a lunch of fried catfish, pinto beans, and cornbread. Andy looked over at Sarge in his apron and dish towel draped over his shoulder.
Damn, Sarge. Looks like you know your way around a kitchen.
Mike called out.
Yeah, he'll make someone a fine wife one of these days.
Sarge slowly turned around. Ted made for the door. Sarge thumbed open his holster and drew the 1911. The very distinct sound of the hammer rolling back sounded like thunder in the cabin. Mike bolted upright and screamed,
Shit!
He shoved Andy ahead of him and ran like hell for the door. Ted was already outside on the deck. Doc had a what-the-fuck look on his face as Mike and Andy nearly knocked him into the swamp. Clearing the door, Andy slammed it shut, leaning against it. His eyes were huge.
He wouldn't really shoot you, would he? He asked.
Well, probably not, Ted said. And then to Mike, Why do you always have to wind him up like that?
Mike grinned. Think of it as a live fire exercise. Andy said, I think DHS is going to have more than it can handle.
I shit you not, Mike said.
Chapter 4 I sat on the porch enjoying a cup of coffee in the quiet of early morning. I used to sleep in, and I really enjoyed it. But since getting home, I couldn't seem to sleep past 6. I was twirling the empty cup like a cowboy with a 6-gun, one of the cups we had bought at Devil's Tower, when I heard my gate rattle. I picked up the AR and walked down the steps. Mark was walking up the drive.
Morning, Mark. What's up?
Morning, Morgan. How's it going? He asked, as he stuck out his hand.
Pretty good. How about you?
Good as can be expected, I guess. I need a favor, he said, with a dour face.
What can I do?
I need your Suburban. I need to go to Tavares and see the sheriff. We need some help out here and some direction on what to do. I have a feeling things are about to go to shit in a big way, he said, his hands resting on his gun belt. He was wearing a pair of BDU pants and a sheriff's office polo shirt, with an SO jacket over it, the big gold star embroidered on it.
I'd be happy to drive you anywhere you need to go. You're the law, and I'm glad you guys are out here, but I can't give you my truck, I said.
He didn't say anything, so I said, That's a problem. We can settle it right now. The law's confiscating vehicles in some of the places I've been. You guys doing the same?
I unslung the carbine from my shoulder and flipped off the safety as I did.
Mark said, Put the rifle down, Morgan. I didn't mean it that way. If you'll take me to where I need to go, then that's fine. But you may be doing more running around than you plan on.
I flipped the safety on and slung the carbine. I'm glad to help. You cover my back, and I'll cover yours. He stood there for a moment, then nodded his head, stuck out his hand, and said, "Deal." We shook hands again, and then I had to ask, "What makes you think things are about to go to shit?" He went on to explain of the rumbling and grumblings coming from up and down the street. He had already had to get involved in a fist fight across the street from his house over a hen. Two men actually brawling in the yard over a chicken. Then there was the water issue. Without power, most folks couldn't pump water. Some of them had generators and were using them sparingly to pump water,